For the better part of the past century, geopolitical power has been intimately connected to fossil fuels. The desire to access and control finite energy resources has been enough to forge alliances, to start wars. But as we transition to a world of clean energy, the old status quo is starting to shift and new winners and losers are emerging. The trajectory of these major geopolitical shifts was recently the subject of a fascinating article in the Financial Times, which we'll put on our website for you. Quite something. And I'm joined now by one of the experts who was interviewed for that piece, Thijs van de Graaf. Thijs is Associate Professor of International Politics at Ghent University in Belgium, and he was the lead author of the 2019 report, A New World, The Geopolitics of the Energy Transformation, commissioned by the International Renewable Energy Agency. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hi. It's good to be here. Thank you.
How would you characterise what seems like this acceleration in the transition away from fossil fuels in the last 12 or 18 months? That was very much the takeout message I got from that Financial Times article.
Yes, definitely. I think over the past year or year and a half or so, two major things have happened. One, of course, is the pandemic, which has not only been a global health and economic crisis, but it has also been an energy crisis in some way, because it has slashed demand for fossil fuels. Oil demand, for example, fell by more than 8% last year, bringing us back to consumption levels last seen in 2012. And at the same time, during the pandemic, renewables kept on growing. So they were the only energy source to keep on growing, to be very resilient, basically accelerating their penetration of the global energy system. Now, the second thing that happened is this, what I call cascades of net zero commitments by major countries. In September, China surprised the world by suddenly committing itself to carbon neutrality by 2060. And we saw that in the wake of China's announcement, other countries like Japan, Korea, South Africa, and others have followed suit and adopted their own net zero commitments. And of course, in the US, the election of Joe Biden as new US president also raises the prospect that the US will join this club anytime soon. So all of a sudden, we see demand for fossil fuels has been hit severely because of the crisis. And at the same time, almost 70% of global emissions now falls under a net zero commitment. And those two forces are potentially a game changer and as you say, an accelerator for the energy transition. Mm.
Yes, because you say that every major geopolitical shift in the past had to do with energy. Now, develop that idea for us, please.
Well, maybe not every geopolitical shift, but I mean, you cannot look at the history of the world from a macro perspective, all of the big geopolitical shifts that have occurred, without keeping an eye on energy. If you look at just the impact of the Industrial Revolution at the beginning of the 19th century, that has changed the face of the world. That has, you know, in the early days catapulted the United Kingdom to rule the waves, as they said. This was fired by coal. In the same vein, in the 20th century, the US rose to global supremacy thanks to its control of oil. People are always surprised when I say that even after World War II, the US was still the biggest oil producer in the world. It's only later that, you know, the center of gravity, the point of gravity shifted to the Middle East. But even then, the US has naval power eclipses the naval power of all other countries. And most of the oil that is produced in the Middle East is exported through tankers, through maritime traffic. So you could say that the US has controlled oil flows to a large extent in the 20th century. And so now the question is, as we shift from fossil fuels altogether, oil, coal, natural gas, towards renewables like solar, wind, supported by additional technologies like batteries, like hydrogen, what effects is this going to have on geopolitical relations?
Well, I presume that the so-called petrostates are the ones who have most to lose from this transition away from fossil fuels. Is that how you see it?
You're quite right. If when you look at the fossil fuel-powered world, that's the world we are still very much in. Fossil fuels provide 80% of worldwide primary energy. The reserves of fossil fuels are very geographically concentrated. In fact, 80% of the world population lives in a country which is a net importer of fossil fuels. So only 20% of the world population lives in those petrol state countries that depend on fossil fuel export revenues. So they have a lot to lose, but obviously they are not all equally vulnerable. I think if you look at the world map today in geopolitical terms, some petrol states are already suffering from what you could call poor governance and conflict. Think about countries like Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, Venezuela. These countries are already experiencing instability. They are already in a troublesome position. The Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, they are somewhat in a better position because they are simply richer in terms of, you know, GDP per capita, and they have much lower production costs. So this buys them a bit more time to adjust. And then you have still other countries like Russia. I think Russia is, it's a category on its own. Its economic base is a bit more diversified than the Gulf countries. But the difference is that Russia plans to double down on its fossil fuel production, which is arguably a risky strategy in a world that is experiencing such a rapid and deep transition.
Look, just before we move on, because there's some very interesting things to consider, I just want to test you a little further about that conviction that you obviously have that this is all going to happen much faster than we might have sensed, which is certainly the theme of that Financial Times article. Why do you think that's necessarily inevitable?
No, I mean, I don't believe that the future is cast in stone. So we'll have to see how this plays out. But I think the potential is certainly there for a very rapid and frankly, also disruptive transition. You know, we are now in 2021 at a point where a decade ago, no one believed we would be at. And by that, I mean, in terms of how low the costs for some renewable technologies have fallen. So the cost reductions for technologies like solar, wind, batteries has been nothing short of spectacular. Costs have come down by 30, sometimes 70%, leading the International Energy Agency, for instance, in its latest World Energy Outlook, to conclude that solar is now the cheapest source of electricity in history. So that means that this energy transition is now in a large extent market-driven. It's in that sense almost unstoppable. Look at what the Trump administration tried to do to revive the ailing coal industry in the US. Didn't work out that way because market forces decided otherwise. Look also at the projections by oil company BP. So that's not Greenpeace, it's BP. Even before the pandemic slashed demand for fossil fuels, they said renewables are entering the global energy system much faster than any fuel ever seen in history. And this plays out over all of their scenarios. So they also
assume,
for instance,
yes, they think peak oil's well and truly passed.
They assume that global oil demand has already peaked in 2019 and will never recover to those levels again. So that's just the speed at which this might unfold. And one thing that is typical for these new technologies is that they tend to follow these S-curves, right, where you have small growth, but then you have a point of acceleration where they start to grow exponentially. And I think if there's one thing that COVID-19 has taught us, that is that people typically tend to underestimate, you know, the speed, scope and impact of exponential growth rates.
Yes, well, look, here, I mean, it's a very big discussion here in Australia, as you can imagine, with our coal reserves. But here we seem to be in a unique position, really, in that we have a lot to lose, but we also have potentially a lot to gain from this transition. I mean, one of our most prominent economic commentators, Ross Garnaut, thinks Australia has the potential to be a, quotes, renewable superpower. Now, do you think that's a fair assessment? Are we a bit unique in that regard?
Yes, definitely. I wouldn't use the term superpower, but you're already a major exporter of energy, mostly coal and gas going to Asian markets. I believe you even have a larger share of exports in coal markets than Saudi Arabia has in oil markets. So you're a big energy force already in world markets. But you're also blessed with very abundant renewables, solar and wind in particular, raising the possibility of making, you know, green energy Australia's next big export products.
Big thing.
And there are already project in the pipeline. You know, there's a plan to build a cable all the way to Singapore to transport electricity. There are other plans to produce renewable hydrogen and export it either as hydrogen or as ammonia. So these things are being planned. And I think, I mean, if you just look at the potential that Australia has in terms of surplus renewable electricity, I think you're quite unique. There are other countries that are also, you know, blessed with abundant renewables, countries from Morocco to Saudi Arabia to Chile. Some of them are also trying to, you know, build up new export industries. But I think you're moving quite fast, and so you're well placed to make this work.
I think you don't like this term, renewable superpower, anyway, do you?
No. No, because, I mean, even if, suppose, you know, you make it work and you're able in Australia to build this new export infrastructure and perhaps more importantly also attract, you know, downstream industries, heavy energy intensive industries like steel, cement, chemicals, and you start to begin exporting green steel instead of green hydrogen, which would frankly deliver even greater benefits, economic benefits to your country, even then, we have to realize that renewable energy sources are not the same as fossil fuel resources. Fossil fuels, as I said, are geographically concentrated. Renewables are dispersed flows of energy, which are available almost in every country.
So it takes frankly, the pressure off people to secure it, sort of thing.
Yes. So, I mean, we will probably never again see such a concentration of wealth and power as we saw in the fossil fuel world. So that's why I'm a bit hesitant to use that term superpower.
Fair enough. No, I see what you mean. I mean, there are certain types of countries, aren't there, that could have an edge in this new geopolitical order. I mean, if you could quickly tell us three broad categories you've identified, could you tell us about them, please?
Yeah, so the first category we've talked about, that's the category of countries with abundant renewable sources. I think, you know, for Australia, it's not that much of a transformation because, as I said, you're already an energy exporter. But think about a country like Chile. Think about a country like Morocco. Those are countries that are heavily reliant on imports of fossil fuels. So to the extent that they could harness their renewable potential and transform it into an export industry, then that is really a change of course, a change of their fates, because they will improve their trade balance substantially and they will able to capture, you know, huge economic benefits from that. That's the first category. Second category is countries rich in all sorts of minerals and metals, which will be needed to power those renewable energy technologies, everything from rare earth minerals to lithium, cobalt, copper, etc. All of these minerals and metals will be needed for batteries, for wind turbines, for all sorts of renewables. So they also stand to gain, at least in theory, because in practice we see, for instance, a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which produces over 70% of the world's cobalt, which is needed in batteries for electric vehicles, for instance. That's a country that is, of course, not benefiting economically to the extent that it could or should, because it's also mired in, you know, poor governance and conflict. Certainly. And then the final category, and I think this will be the biggest beneficiaries, are countries that, you know, are able to gain a position of technological leadership in key technologies of the future.
And this is what the US is worried about China for, isn't it?
Absolutely. So when it comes to this, the clean energy technology race, it's sometimes called, all eyes are now on China, which I think has, to say it mildly, it has taken a formidable head start in this its clean energy technology race. It already produces 70% of the world's photovoltaic solar panels, half of all electric vehicles worldwide, and more than 30% of all wind turbines. So it's a manufacturing powerhouse for sure. But it's able.
It also,
you know,
has
to produce
incredible fuel fossil fuel emissions rates too.
Yes, absolutely. It's highly dependent on coal. It's still in the top 10 of world oil producers. Absolutely. But what China is doing, it's thinking very strategic about these technologies. They had already in 2015, they developed a plan which was called Made in China 2025, eyeing a leadership role for China in electric vehicles, or what they call clean energy vehicles, you know, to not rule out hydrogen vehicles from the start. And this is, you know, all part of a plan to gain a foothold in the automotive industry, which traditionally has been, you know, one of the engines of development in countries like Germany, Korea, Japan. China has tried to, you know, gain a foothold in the industries through electric vehicles. And we now see that in terms of mass production, bringing cheap EVs to the market, China is already doing better than other countries. So yes. That's basically how they work.
Yes, and then they're sort of, you know, they're sort of trying, to, in effect, trying to control much of the high voltage electricity interconnections too, is another area that is, you know, really revealing when you look closely. Look, I just want to leave with this really important issue. I think there's differences of opinion, Tis, as to whether this transition to renewables that you're describing will result in more conflict and geopolitical tension or less. Now, what are your thoughts on this?
I think you put it rightly. I think there are two schools of thoughts, a pessimistic and an optimistic, you could say. And my personal view is that there's a lot of ground for optimism because of, you know, the structural differences in technology between renewables and fossil fuels. I think that the transition itself might be a bit messy, might be a bumpy road rather than a smooth sailing. But, you know, when you get to the end point, and that is also why the report by the Global Commission was called A New World, when you reach the end point, then I think there's a lot of promise in, you know, seeing just a reduction in geopolitical conflicts, much of which today is still tied to oil and gas. If you take that out of the system and replace it with decentralized renewables, which offer a lot of potential for energy democracy, for energy independence, also for import-dependent countries, I think then we should be hopeful that this brings about a more peaceful
A sea world. Of tranquility. We'll learn to compete about something else, but maybe it does take away that particular pressure that's dominated the part, you know, lots of the 20th century. Look, I prefer to take your optimistic view. Thank you very much indeed for joining us for that wonderful overview.
Thank you for having me.
Tis van der Graaf, Associate Professor of International Politics at Ghent University, the Geopolitics of the Energy Transformation is the report that he authored in 2019. But I do commend to you the Financial Times article, which we've put on our website, which was this marvellous overview, very persuasive, I think, suggesting things really are shifting.